Hello, and thanks for listening to the Fire Engineering Podcast. Please be sure to join us for our upcoming webcasts with trainers such as George Healy, Anthony Avillo, Jerry Tracy, and Jack Murphy. You can find all our webcast offerings at fireengineering.com/webcasts. They're all free, and you can watch them on demand with your crew.
Welcome to the Women in Fire radio show, Cancer in the Fire Service. Thank you to Fire Engineering for allowing Women in Fire to be part of your radio show. I'm Lisa Baker, the Southwestern Trustee for Women in Fire. Today, I have a wealth of knowledge with my guests. I have Fire Chief Chris Bloom, who's the Fire Chief in Meridian Fire, which is in Idaho. Prior to Meridian, he worked in the city of Tucson, Arizona, where he rose through the ranks, and he has over 2 decades in the fire service. I have Captain John Galuta, who is a captain in the Tucson, Arizona Fire Department, who's been in the fire service for over 34 years. He's been with Tucson since 1997. He's the first fire captain to hold the position of Health and Safety Program Coordinator. He chairs the Southern Arizona Safety Committee, and since 2015, Captain Galuta has represented Tucson Fire and collaborated with the University of Arizona and several studies funded by FEMA to examine the link between occupational toxins in firefighters and increased rates of cancer and develop best practices for cancer prevention. He also serves as a representative for broader firefighter cancer cohort study and for 3 years research project to develop a test framework among a limited set of fire service partners for establishing a long-term firefighter multi-center prospective cohort study focused on addressing our limited understanding of which individual exposures are responsible for cancer in firefighters and how they cause cancer and most effective means of reducing exposures. Thank you to my guests again. So as we know, January is Firefighter Cancer Awareness Month. The month is for raising awareness to the dangers firefighters face being exposed to toxins and soot when they go to fires. Cancer is well recognized as a significant risk in the fire service. Attention has increasingly focused on cancer risks and cancer preventions in the fire service and a variety of research, education, behavioral changes, and a variety of controls to minimize exposures to contaminants. The National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, which is NIOSH, undertook 2 large studies focused on firefighter cancers and concluded that firefighters face a 9% increase in cancer diagnosis and a 14% increase in cancer-related deaths compared to the general population in the United States. And efforts to raise awareness in the fire service of the heightened risk of cancer and ways to reduce exposures, valuable video presentations have been produced by organizations, including, among others, the Boston Fire Department. These videos help to inform firefighters of the steps they can take to address the hazards they face. The Firefighter Cancer Support Network is another excellent resource for accessing information on health and safety related topics and support and mentorship following a cancer diagnosis. Many local news stations across the United States have also done nightly news stories on the risks and dangers firefighters face, including the increased risk of cancer that has led to firefighter deaths. We know many carcinogens make it past our PPE and onto our skin. A video made in 2015, results of a fluorescent aerosol screening test, illustrated how carcinogens get through our PPE, particularly the hood and interfaces between the jacket and pants and between the pants and the boots. This study had prompted a number of PPE design changes and revised PPE cleaning practices. Without the proper use of SCBA, firefighters are at risk for inhaling these carcinogens as well. Many departments now have SOGs and rules and regs in place that require SCBAs to be worn throughout the overhaul process and continual air monitoring. Since 2013, the Firefighter Cancer Support Network has urged departments to implement gross decon on scene. Gross decon procedures on scene using soap and water and a brush are approximately 85% effective in removing soot. Dry decon using a brush to remove soot and other debris while on air is an option in cold weather. Many departments have also begun the use of fire decon wipes, which are used to eliminate harmful toxins on the skin, but should not take the place of taking a shower immediately upon return to quarters. Many departments now have a process where the members are issued 2 sets of hoods and the hoods are exchanged after a fire. Many departments have 2 sets of turnouts, and departments when the 2 sets have policies in place to ensure that gross decon is done on scene. Yet we must think beyond PPE. We must think about exhaust systems. The diesel exhaust was classified as a known human carcinogen in June of 2012. Where do we store our PPE when it's not in use is also important. Do we leave it sitting right on the apparatus floor right next to the gear, or do we have separate apparatus, or do we have separate rooms off the apparatus floor where we store our SCBAs? And there also is a clean cab concept that revolves around the principle that the dirtiest and most likely exposed soil equipment from a fire incident are totally isolated from the apparatus cab and stored in an exterior and or sealed compartment. So when we were in recruit school, we trained the members on a myriad of different things. We trained them on building construction, hose lines, ventilation and stuff. So should we have a cancer prevention class to be implemented in recruit school, or do your departments already have that where we teach them about the prevention of cancer in recruit school? Whoever would like to take a shot at that.
Lisa, this is Heidi. I can go ahead and start with that since I am closer to that academy age. Guys, we're probably all the same age. We do have a cancer prevention program that's talked about in our academy. We've had 4 line of duty deaths from cancer in the last few years. So we're pretty proactive about it starting in the academy, which includes not just decon, but having 2 sets of gear in the academy and just following all those proper procedures that you spoke about. So for us, we think it's imperative because that's when they're really going through. If you think about the number of burns an academy participant goes through, their exposure level is so much higher. So we really need to take care of that early on, and it establishes a good practice for them.
Thanks, Heidi.
Hey Lisa, this is John. So one of the things that Tucson Fire Department has been doing since 2013 is we're actually onboarding all of our recruits for our cancer research that we're doing, and we're actually following them. So we're actually getting biologicals. Obviously, they consent in, so it is a voluntary thing. I know they're recruits, but they're still voluntary. And we onboard them into our cancer research, and we actually collect biologicals before their first training fire. That way we can actually follow them, and we're getting ready to come up on our 6th year of doing this since 2015. We're coming up on year 6 to see what changes are going on from the day they walked in to the study to as they go every 2 years, we collect these biologicals from them. So it's education, but it's also part of them being involved with their own research, because this is the future for the fire service, right? So we're making a little bit of a change, but we're also involving them in the change, which is kind of really paramount.
Thank you. So as people come in, I think you both have just emphasized the fact that we have to start teaching it when they first come into recruit school to get it ingrained into their so-called memory, that the importance of the cancer prevention and stuff. And I apologize, I forgot to introduce my third host, my third panel member, which is Heidi Simon, who is a lieutenant in the South Metro Fire Department. And she has over 24 years of experience, and she's served on both the wellness and safety committees in her agency. Sorry about that, Heidi.
No worries. And John, I think that's awesome that you're starting with those early studies, because, you know, we're looking back at some of the studies that San Francisco has done, and everyone's already been exposed. They did some work with comparing it to the general public, the general society, and found some pretty interesting correlations. But I think that starting from the beginning, whether it's with training and blood work, all of that is going to help to increase the prevention later in their careers.
Absolutely. The other kind of a unique piece to it is that with any research, you always have to compare your population, right? So we're talking about the fire service in general to the general public. And that's kind of what the Dr. Daniels and NIOSH did back when they did that retrospective study, or the retrospective, one of those two. Anyway, so we're basically, you know, the recruits, our probationary firefighter recruits, are 98% of them have never been firefighters before. So we actually have the general population within our own organization, but now we can actually follow them, which is even adding an additional piece to it. So every single recruit class since then, we've actually onboarded them. We're getting ready to onboard 2022 class in March into the study. So pretty excited about, you know, where we're at right now. It's year six, doesn't seem like it's been that long, but yet seems like it's taken a long time. So
I think one of the real benefits to that is keeping it fresh in their mind. If you're getting blood work done every year, that is reminding them that we're still in the process of trying to prevent cancer, but we're also still exposed, because I find that many of our people get very complacent once they've been on for a couple of years. So I think that's a really good way to keep them up to date.
And Heidi, I agree. So you mentioned that, so we all know that when we hire firefighters into our agencies, they go through an extensive background, extensive medical and such. And you talked about pre-blood work and such. So when a member leaves your agency, do any of your agencies have a post-exit?
Physical,
thank you. Adam.
We try to. A lot of folks just want to get the heck out sometimes. We do the best to do that. Yeah, we do the best we can to try to catch that. We also try to also get them to talk to our psychologist that we have with the Tucson Fire Department as well as part of that exiting piece, so that they can kind of help them understand the changes that's going to be in retirement. It could be a different life for them. So it's not just the physical piece, but it's also the mental piece or the emotional piece to it.
Wow, that's actually an excellent program you have there. So gone are the days of, we've all been in the fire department over 25 years. So we all first came in, the days of looking salty, dirty, and having turnout dirty gear and equipment was a sign, a badge of honor, so to speak. So what policies do your agencies have with regards to like hood swaps, turnout cleaning, apparatus cleaning and such, and how strictly are they followed?
You know what, Lisa, I'd like to kick off on that one, if you don't mind, real quick. I think one of the things that you highlighted right off the bat, what you were talking about, an image, the quintessential, the iconography that goes along with the salty firefighter. And that's difficult to change, because that image is burnt into what we perceive, what society perceives, is a hardworking, you know, firefighter that is vetted and valid, and people will follow that individual in, you know, into a dangerous environment. And so, you know, talking about, you know, Tucson Fire does have a flagship program for cancer prevention and the study. But as a service, as the fire service, whether it's volunteer, paid professional in a small market or in a metro service, breaking that iconography, breaking down that barrier to where people do not view the salty helmet, the ash covered, this, that, and the other, the burnt out turnouts where the reflective tape is curling up from heat, is difficult. And I think that what Tucson Fire is doing, what Heidi's talking about is being done in her area, is critically important. We're talking about capturing the hearts and minds of the young, the people that are coming into this profession, in this industry. And I don't want to, you know, embellish or make it something that it's not, but scaring these people straight. If cancer is, in fact, the second leading cause of line of duty deaths, are we serious about it? And honestly, it as a fire chief, it's cheap to say, yeah, we're doing everything we can to prevent fire. But are we really? And the reality is this has to happen at the training academy with the firefighters and then with our lieutenants, captains, and sergeants in the station. Because I have no capacity to police that, nor do I have the desire to police at that level. It has to be that we have a change in the culture and attitudes as well as the behaviors at the fire station level. I can provide you two sets of turnouts, a second hood, extractor, expellers, and all of that stuff. But if it hasn't been culturally accepted by the firefighters, we're going nowhere. We're spinning our wheels. And so that, in my opinion, is our challenge.
You've nailed it, Chief. You absolutely nailed it. That is the challenge, right? Because that the icon is still out there and we see it just the other day all over fire engineering, firehouse, with departments that don't have the same initiatives. And when you're in a department that doesn't necessarily see as much fire, there is that bravado that comes out that I want that dirty face. And it's frightening for us that have been in the service for a while, but it is the lieutenants, the captains, and I'm going to have to talk to you about sergeants because that's interesting to me on another note. But those are the people that set the tone for the people for the future. So, empowering them with that task is critical. And without that, the younger people are not going to be successful. But I think that we've all admitted it has to start in the academy.
It's kind of interesting with the research and studies that we've been doing in this implementation of new SOPs. It's the first 2 and 3 year firefighters, 100% on board. The people that are getting ready to retire because they hear about what's going to happen in retirement, they're on board. It's my 10 to 15 year, which is unfortunately where a supervision, that's where our supervisors are at, that 10 to 15 year time period. And so that's the struggle because they have the culture piece still in their heads and so still haven't bought in 100%, still have, like Chief Bloom was saying, that bravado of that macho dirtiness. And so it's this tough category is that's the people that you're counting on extending the chief's message down the field and keeping an eye on making sure that the junior people are doing it. But they're the ones right now that's my biggest struggle to get them to embrace this.
Yeah, I could see that. And Heidi, you brought up a good point about something that was all over fire engineering and such the other day. And Chief Bloom, you had mentioned, you know, the persona of what a hero looks like and such. And I think, Heidi, we might be referring to the same picture that we saw, that there was an individual with a dirty face and a helmet on that looked like it had taken quite a bit of heat, that saying, I think one of the captions said, here's a hero. And yeah, he was a hero, but I think the four of us sitting here are thinking, well, how long did he have the helmet on? How long did he have the suit and such on his face? So we kind of were probably, and I'm speaking for you guys, and I might be out of line here, we were probably looking at it as, yeah, he was a hero, but how long did he maybe have that on his head that with that dirty helmet? How long was that suit on? And so I think, Chris, I think you were right when you said the persona of what a hero looks like. Sometimes the media doesn't help us with the message we're trying to get out to our members about the dirty equipment and such.
Lisa, and oftentimes, quite frankly, you don't want to take away from the situation that is captured in a nanosecond by a photo. I just get the chills even thinking about pulling up on that building or any building in my district that could be similar to that, and what we may look like following that and the judgment that could ensue. So there's more of a history behind it then. But I think that if we go back to what our picture of a firefighter hero looks like, it's often similar, whether it's that picture or any of them. So I think I want to make sure that we don't take away from what just happened, but at the same time, recognize that that person at some point is going to have a family and a child or many children. And we, the last thing we want is for that person to leave behind a widow or widower.
No, I agree with you, Heidi. And I was just using that as an example of what we think the general population thinks of as a hero. And then that's kind of embedded in people's heroes. And he was a hero.
Absolutely.
He was a total hero for what he did in that situation.
Absolutely.
So with the increase of carcinogens industrial-wide being used in building materials nationwide, how do we protect our personnel prior to and being exposed to these products? So we talked about the training that we do in the academy and stuff, but if there is there something more that we could be doing to instill in them the need to follow the policies and such, I guess is where I'm trying to go.
These type of building materials are not going away. We don't have the legacy building materials anymore that we've had in the past, the big timbers and stuff like that. They're not going away. So I think what's really important is that we are using science and the evidence-based approach and educating the people on what happens with them, the limitations to them, as well as what happens to them when they get superheated. It also is important for us to educate and to continue to educate folks about what's happening with the exposure to us, because we're looking at soot, but we think it's dirt and it's macho. But if they understood that the three ways you get exposed, right, normally ingestion and inhalation, right? And if we understand that what happens with that, that's an exposure. What happens to us when everything gets, those things get on us or get in us, what they're doing to us. And my biggest eye opener is when I started listening to the researchers explain it, and I'm telling you, I have to have them really dummy it down for me, because I am definitely not the researcher at all. I'm a firefighter at heart, and getting them to make me understand what's happening is the part that's the scariest, because it's not that we want to change firefighting. We're not telling them how to put wet stuff on the red stuff. It's to understand what that is doing to us and how we can start doing the minimization of it, but also understanding that these building materials are not going away, and we need to understand that they're toxic and we have to be aware of that. And we have to stop waddling around in it and wading around in that dirt and filth.
Heidi or Chris, do you have anything to add on that?
I'm sorry, Heidi, go ahead, please.
Go ahead, Chief.
I think John's right. Kind of getting back to your question there, Lisa, which I think was a great one. And then just to kind of highlight what John said, and I think it's really important, you know, these types of building materials aren't going away. Okay, so it's lighter, faster, quicker, better, because that drives the bottom line down. So if we're talking about the building, the occupancy, or a vehicle under a fire or heated conditions, I think that it's really important for us as an industry, and certainly from my perspective, to start looking at it way before apparatus response. We need to start looking at the design and engineering that's going into these buildings, and then we need to start looking at the suppression and prevention and notifications systems that are being built into these occupancies or these vehicles. Because if I can prevent an apparatus response with firefighters and then exposing themselves, then that's where we need to focus our energy and efforts on. You know, great, clean cabs are awesome, turnouts, extractor expellers, all this. But if I can prevent the firefighter from being exposed in the first place, how far back can I go to prevent that response that prevents the cascade of events that follows after that? We will always respond. That is our job and that is our duty. However, from my perspective, if I truly love the profession and love the people that I'm sending into harm's way, how can I prevent them from going on the call in the first place? And I think that that's where we as a profession and as an industry need to start looking, is how can we continue to prevent the emergency from happening in the first place? Because again, to John's point, the decomposition of these materials under a heated environment are getting nasty and methyl ethyl bad stuff is happening. And there is no way to prevent that from happening under in fire conditions. So how do we prevent it in the first place? And that would be where I would stress that we need to spend our time, money, and effort.
Thanks. Chief, I have a question about that. I completely agree with you. And it's funny that, you know, when you're a four-year firefighter, you're like, no, we don't want to prevent fires. We want to go to fires. And now we're at that point where it's like, wow, this is not good. I don't want to go to somebody's house that was just ruined, that they have to now live in a hotel for the next 2 years while they're rebuilding. But with that said, we've done something with the diesel engines, because we do know that diesel exhaust causes, is a carcinogen. And so we have a variety of things that our department does to try and avoid the diesel exhaust. I'm wondering, do you know anything about the potential carcinogen or carcinogenic properties of DEF? Because I know that California was looking into that and couldn't get any information. But when we talk about how these products of combustion get burned so quickly, so that they are coming into smaller and smaller particles, which are more easily absorbed into our skin and into our respiratory system. And then I look at DEF, which is exactly what it's done to diesel. So to me, it seems like it would be more of a carcinogenic situation, but I don't know, do you guys know anything about that?
Well, to give you my perspective on that, boy, you hit
can
something
of worms.
Right off. You hit something right out of the chute. You're like, yeah, hey, the 4-year firefighter. Well, I can tell you about the 14-year firefighter or the captain myself. Rolling on a fire, praying to God that the homeowner's green line or garden hose doesn't put the fire out before I get there. So yes, I would be disingenuous and lying out of my mouth if I didn't say I wanted to not go to the big one. Test and try out my skills and talents and abilities and see how good we are or aren't. That being said, I would deflect or defer my question or your question on DEF or diesel, the clean capture, any of that stuff to Captain Galata, certainly, yeah. Because I think that, again, Tucson Fire does lead the way in that sort of research. And I know that there's been a body of research that's been collected through Tucson Fire on that piece.
So diesel exhaust obviously was a concern inside the stations. And so we did a lot of monitoring utilizing the year of the vehicle at certain stations. So we did all stations and then we paid attention to the year of the vehicle and the type of emission systems, because in 2017, the fire trucks had a heck of a lot higher regulatory restriction or regulatory needs, I guess, for another better choice of words, in making sure that they were running cleaner because of where they were. And we did notice a significant difference now that they have newer vehicles. And like Chief said, DEF and these different pieces to it. Also, you know, we went back and forth, direct capture versus the systems that constantly filter out in the bays and stuff. So the answer is yes, diesel exhaust is bad. Fire trucks are actually getting better, which is a good thing. And I think that this is where the fire service holds these manufacturers accountable. They need to be working with us. We need to tell them what we want, and it's their job. If they want to sell us something, it's their job to meet those standards. It's the same thing with a researcher. We shouldn't wait for a researcher to tell us what they want to research. We should come to them and say, this is what we want you to research, and we follow them through it. Same thing with the manufacturer, whether it's turnouts, helmets, fire trucks, air packs. And I think that's one of the things that the fire service needs to do a little bit better on, is just not just say, here's a project and come back to me with your answer. I think we need to be collaborators and partners with all of them to making sure that we're getting what we need, and that's the health and safety for our folks. So going back to the diesel exhaust systems, I think that they're getting, or diesel trucks and diesel itself, I think fire engines are getting better. We're requiring, at least in Tucson, that they're a certified clean vehicles, which means that they're DEF and there's some other pieces. But do all fire departments know that when they're purchasing the vehicles? And that's the uneducation that we didn't do for each one of these services. So I don't think we do a good job getting the information out, saying when you buy a truck, make sure you look for this. It's not just red and aluminum wheels and 750 gallon tank, we need all the pieces to tie together.
I don't know that you can get a new fire truck without having the DEF system now. Mm-hmm. Everything that we've purchased in the last 5 years is set up that way. But my concern is the DEF better? We'll have different trucks that go through different amounts of it. Maybe the same year, same model, same make. And it's interesting to me kind of why, and then what is that being broken down into? Have you seen any research at all on that?
So the mining companies are actually, think about it, they're bringing diesel trucks inside of mines, and they're the ones that have the best research on it. And actually, Dr. Burgess from the University of Arizona that we've been working with also works with mining companies. So I would definitely reach out to him and ask that question. I mean, I haven't directly asked that, and it is a good question. I paid attention to what our folks are purchasing in depth and those kind of things. And we do know just by doing some monitoring that the stations that do have them have a reduced diesel particulates inside of the apparatus bays. And so that's a good thing. So they are reducing that a little bit, but I haven't gotten any more in depth of it. But I bet you that he would definitely have some good information seeing how mines are inside enclosed environments.
Excellent. Thank you.
And speaking of the diesel exhaust and such, I kind of mentioned that sometimes when you go to a fire station or if you drive by a fire station in another city or something, and I think it's human nature because we're firefighters, we look into the apparatus bay of fire stations and such. And we're still seeing SCBAs lying on the floor. We're still seeing the PPEs lying on the floor next to the exhaust systems and such. So do you guys have policies in place for that? Or how do we stop from, I mean, I get in the morning at the change of shift, somebody might jump on the rig and take the other person's PPE out and put it on the floor and such, but how do we instill in our members that having that equipment on the ground by the diesel is not the safest avenue for where it should be? If we're trying to like educate. So the whole thing about trying to prevent cancer in the fire services, as we've been talking about, is education. And that it starts at the training division, and it's a cultural change pretty much. I mean, we talked about the soot on the face and the dirty helmets and such, and it being a badge of honor, so to speak. And we've all been in the fire service long enough to have seen that. So how do we change that culture that we don't just leave the PPE on the ground, that is also part of cancer prevention, not having the PPE on the ground because of the diesel exhaust, since we were just talking about the diesel?
Lisa, I'm gonna set John up for a. I'm gonna set John Galata up, Captain Galata up here a little bit. But what you talked about, and you said it, it's about culture. It's about a culture of an agency. It's about what they do and why they do it. So PPE, if we can't impart the notion that your PPE is designed to keep you alive, in both the immediate circumstance that you're utilizing it, and for the long-term benefit, then we're failing as an agency. Okay, so let me give you an example. I'll parlay an example here, I think I can do this. So let's imagine that if you are a pilot and the FAA and all the airlines that you fly require you to do a pre-flight inspection. So now we're talking about the SCBA laying on the floor. We're talking about our clean capture diesel system not being attached. So a pilot has to go around the aircraft and they check it out, whether he or she looks, you know, at all of these little pieces and parts. And the immediate consequence, this is the important piece, I think, the immediate consequence of not doing your job or not being accurate in what you were doing has immediate consequence. So the reality is on the firefighter, we have to figure out a way. And that's why this is where I'm setting John up here. What we have to do is we have to set our firefighters to understand that the immediate consequence of getting a burn on your ear or that you get a burn on the wristlet where you're is the immediate consequence. However, there is a long-term consequence. And those long-term consequences are the things that we need to start having the conversation about. Those long-term consequences need to be the drivers of this cultural shift and the cultural change that we need to have happen. Okay, John, you're up.
um, trying to figure out the direction how I want to go with this one. So, you know, you're right, is how do we educate them? And Chief Bloom was talking about this, is that now that we know that keeping the trucks on, or keeping our gear on the floor, even for when you're not on shift and you have them hanging there, right? That's the way the stations were designed years ago, that everybody's gear was on the floor and you hung it there when you weren't on shift. And as people working, we know that their diesel exhaust is getting on your gear. And so one of the things that we looked at, obviously, is on new remodels, is that we're now creating diesel turnout gear rooms, right? But then some folks say, well, our station's not due for a remodel for another 10 years. What do we do? So one of the things that we did actually is an immediate thing is we picked up an inexpensive Connex box and we put fans inside the Connex box to keep them vented, and we pulled them off of the floors and putting them inside of Connex boxes. So it's an inexpensive short-term fix until that station is due for a remodel, so it doesn't affect the chief's budget too much. Talking about, you know, a $1,500, $1,800 Connex box and some fans. So there's options that we have to go down there, but it comes down to that educational piece. But it's also, once again, goes back to the supervisor, who is the immediate supervisor, the house captain, that has to enforce, get your stuff off the floors, get your stuff where they need to belong, and make sure that they keep it clean, because as their dirty gears hanging there, it's touching or coming in contact with everybody else's gear, and it's transferring all that information or soot or dust or dirt or whatever else that's along with it.
Thanks, both of you. Chief, you brought up a really good point about educating them on the, like the burn is immediate, but what's the long-term effect of that? And I think trying to get something like the cancer change, I mean, I think if you were to go to any fire station in the United States right now, you probably could ask firefighters, is cancer a concern of yours? And you might get some no answers, because it just hasn't been brought up the way that it should be in some agencies, is my take on it when I was doing some research for this show. So I think, Chris, Chief, you made a good point that you have to the long-term effect of what this is going to have on your health and such. And I think, John, you brought that up earlier as well. In like in the training division, it's like it can't be as simple as you need to wash your turnouts after every, we need to do gross decon, we need to wash our turnouts, get into our second set, take the first set to the extractor and such. I think that the culture has to be, why are we doing it? We can't just, it's like we could tell, we could lead people somewhere, but we have to explain why we're doing it. That's my take on this, of like, what's the importance of it? Like the equipment on the floor and such. It's like, I mean, that's just my take. So it's like the cultural change is not going to happen overnight. And it's gradually, I think, changing. I mean, like I said, the image of the dirty firefighter and stuff, now so many more agencies have the gross decon, the fire wipes and such at scenes. When you go back to stations, take a shower and such. The last few assessment centers I've done, one of the follow-up questions is, what do you need to do to close out this incident? And they're looking for their cancer prevention is one of their answers that they're looking for. So that's within the last year, that's become a lot more prevalent, I want to say, in agencies. So I think it's gradually getting to where it needs to be. But my personal opinion is we still have a long way to go. And I could be wrong on that, but I think that we still have a long way to go with the educational part of it. And we thank people like John for the research that he does. And like Tucson Fire is like one of the leading agencies with the cancer prevention. So we thank you for that, John.
No, Lisa, you set that up perfectly, actually. It's interesting because you ask what do we do and how do we get there? And I think that if we look at the fire service as anything less than a battleship, we're missing the mark. We can't change a course of direction overnight. It's incremental. And those incremental changes happen at the fire station. The fire chief can ask and say and do whatever he or she chooses or asks, and it can be capricious, but it needs to be backed up with science and evidence-based research in order to get any level of buy-in. And I will tell you right now, the question that needs to be asked around the coffee table that the fire chief needs to ask people, or that they're, you know, the battalion chief or the station captain or the firefighter, is, do you love the people that you work with? Are we just being You know, is it just an aphorism that we say that you go, I go, and I, you know, hey, I want you to go home in the morning after your shift. Well, that's cool, right? That's a great notion. There's a lot of good feel good behind that. But what are you doing to actually affect that? And again, if we're being honest, if the second leading cause, I brought it up before, the second leading cause of line of duty deaths is from occupational cancer. Do you love the people you work with? Because I can tell you right now firsthand, I don't know anybody that has died from a cardiovascular injury or insult in the fire service, but I can tell you of five people, I could give you their names, their wives' names, their children's names, five people that have died from occupational cancer from the fire service. And I know for a fact they never joined the fire service to get occupational cancer and die from it. So my question again, do you love the people that you work with? And if you do, you're going to implement what you can do where you are right now, the things that you can do to prevent your firefighters from getting occupational cancer. Don't talk to me about the fire chief doesn't support extractor expellers. The fire chief doesn't support clean capture diesel. The fire chief, what can you do? What can you do? Stop complaining about what I'm not doing. And let's talk about what you are doing at the coffee table, at your fire station, at a fire scene, after an event. Because if you're not doing it at your level, don't expect it to be pushed down from mine.
Chief, that was...
Sorry, I will get off my soapbox.
No, you know what? I agree with you 100%. I mean, because there's so much that can be happening at the local, at the company level. And so you're right, like the gross decon and such. I mean, we all have brush. We could all, you know, go buy a brush. We could all do that. So I agree with you. I think a lot of agencies, unfortunately, do have that notion, well, the chief doesn't do this, or admin doesn't do that. And we place all the blame when anything goes wrong on admin. When things go right, we kind of look the other way and we don't give the credit to where admin is due their credit. And I think that you made some excellent points there, Chief. And I agree with everything you just said 100%, that I still don't think that some members in the fire service see that the cancer is such a risk. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's my personal idea that, like you mentioned, you know, five people that died. I just saw yesterday where Tucson Fire did a memorial for somebody after that just passed from lung cancer. So I still think that in some organizations and in some people's mindsets in the fire service, it's just still not that big issue, or they think if they just brush the stuff off when they're at the scene and go back and take a shower, everything will be fine. I mean, I think we could probably all go to a fire station after a fire and still walk in that next morning and know that somebody had a fire, because the inside of the cab and the SCBAs and stuff aren't cleaned up to the probably as good as they should be cleaned. So, I mean,
all right, I want to say one last thing on this, but this is to your point, Lisa, when I was back working at in Tucson, it was interesting because part of the cancer study is they were getting, you know, physicians and doctors and, you know, people with PhDs and big degrees and big brains. They were coming out to our fire training center. And one of the things that we've done, fire departments probably still doing it. You know, you get done with a fire, you roll the hose up, where do you put it?
Cab of the truck.
Cab of the engine.
Yeah, we were putting it in the engine, in the cab, with us. And these people with PhDs and big brains were saying, you're putting that hose that you just went into the fire, you're putting it in the cab with you? And it was so obvious, because that's the way we've always done it. But we were like, wait a second. You just figured something out that we were incapable of seeing because it was right in front of our face.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. All of these changes aren't dramatic. No. They're not huge. It's not a shift, this huge shift. Sometimes it's simple. And sometimes it takes an outsider looking in saying, hey, I'm confused about this process. I'm confused about these decisions. Walk me through it.
Yeah.
I keep that you mentioned that. So during the research, when we first started doing this research, one of the things that we would do is all the research teams from the University of Arizona would do ride-alongs. They'd actually come to the station. It didn't make a difference if they were people that did data or if they worked in the lab and they analyzed things, they would all come out and they would be part, if they were part of our study in any form, they would come out and they would do ride-alongs with us. And in the same retrospect, me and two other captains would actually go to every single meeting at the University of Arizona so that we can understand what they were saying and I can understand that vice versa, so that we know each other's jobs. And it was funny, they asked a question one time and I'm sitting in this room and they're PhDs that you couldn't hit a swing a cat without hitting a PhD in that room. And I was definitely the lowest common denominator when it came to academia. And one of the lab guys looked at me and goes, I forget what even the topic was. We said, well, why do you guys do it that way? And my only answer was because that's the way we've always done it. And I'll tell you what, I felt like I should have been a third grader. I felt so silly when I made that answer. And it was just dawned on me at that point. So from then on, every time that we create a graph or a chart with data on it, I also remind everybody that each one of those dots or somebody in this department, one of the firefighters, and I put faces that pop up when I do this, and it points to one of these dots and say, this could be a fellow firefighter. We have to make it personal and they have to understand it. But it's funny, Chief, when you say that, it's like, well, that's the way we've always done it. Was literally the dumbest thing I've ever said in my life. And it was, how often do we say that?
A lot.
A lot.
We say that a lot in the fire service. That's the way we've always done it.
Yep.
Yeah, I would like to have a button that says, no, we can't allow to say that anymore. Yeah. Because it typically has to do with something that you can't put a definition of why we really do it, right? And it usually is something that's pretty detrimental to what we do. I wanted to go back to Chief when you were talking about that when the line is questioning, what is the chief doing? You're not buying me a new engine. You're not, you know, I think there are so many things that chiefs can do that is based around the dollar. But I think the most important thing that our chiefs have done is to create a cancer policy that allowed us as officers to take the time after a fire to go out of service. And we have a second set of air pack straps, for instance. So we change everything out and we're given the time to do that. You know, we try to do it quickly, obviously, get everybody rotating through showers but we're given that time and that opportunity to take it if as officers. And the other thing that they are trying to do, and obviously it's going to take money, so it has to be budgeted over a number of years, is trying to get us out of our bunker gear as much as possible. So we wear bunker gear for fire alarms, we wear them for fires, we wear them for all our MVAs, and they're really trying to look at something that we can wear that doesn't have the PFAs in it just to lessen our exposures. So we know that it's going to be a while before we get it, but just the fact that they're talking about that is encouraging for us. Also changing different types of hoods and things like that. But I think that as a chief, if you are empowering your officers and letting them know you have this grace to take care of your people after a fire, I think that goes a long way because it not only backs up your officers. So when you're taking somebody out of service to do that, it gives them the credence to get it done. So,
you know, Heidi, you're absolutely right. And I'll tell you right now, if your fire chief isn't looking at that, and I'm not speaking specifically to yours, but any of the audience listeners, if they're not looking at that, you need to be looking for a new fire chief. Because again, I mean, this is not some arbitrary position that people on the line are taking. It is backed by science. It's evidence based. I mean, these are not capricious decisions that people are trying to make to adversely impact operations. And so I think that this is really important. And you hit on something that I really, really enjoy, and it's that whole mission-driven culture thing. You know, you can have policy manuals and books and rules and regulations, but I really believe in this idea of a mission-driven culture. And if your decision to take your company out of service to protect them because you love your crew, right? Then I don't understand. I struggle with the idea of why a chief or a chief officer at any rank would have a problem with that. I would struggle.
I totally agree.
It supports the mission. It's in you're taking care of your people. And at the end of the day, if we're not taking care of the people, we can't take care of the public. We can't support the mission. So people are our people, come first, period.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we lost a term about 15 years ago. When I first started in the fire service, we talked about our internal customers and our external customers. And what we would do for our external customers, we should also do for our internal customers. And what we wouldn't do, we shouldn't do for each of those. And one of them was wearing bunker gear into someone's home. And we wouldn't do that in our home and in our station. It's not allowed. Why would we willingly walk into somebody's home? And we wash our gear after every fire in an extractor, but I still don't want, it's got diesel, it's got all sorts of things. I don't want that in my home. It's not going in someone else's home. And that's part of our policy, but it's also bringing it down to the level of, hey guys, would you do this to your family? So.
Exactly. We have to be able to take care of our internal customers to be able to take care of our external customers, so to speak. So, John, maybe you could answer this. I think in 2015, I could be wrong with the exact year and such. I think that's when the videos started being made and such about the cancer in the fire service. Is that like when the real research and such started just in 2015, or was there research behind that that really wasn't out there that the fire service really wasn't that aware of?
I think the research started getting momentum when Dr. Daniels from NIOSH published in 2012, it started. Okay. But our research that we did with University of Arizona was to answer a question when one of our members that was diagnosed with a presumptive cancer was denied. And so one of the questions and one of the reasons behind it was that even our workers' comp folks knew that there was not any science to show a firefighter was being exposed after fire, which basically means nobody followed a firefighter after fire and did biological collection. So that's what we did for that 3-year time period. So in order for you to become statistically significant or in science or be evidence-based, you have to have enough folks, enough data, and enough time period for all the processes to happen. And so I think from 2013 to 15 is when momentum really started in. Once we realized and somebody had done the exposure piece, now what happens to us after exposures, and that's kind of that momentum shift as it's going in research in different directions.
Okay. So does Arizona have presumptive cancer laws in place?
They do. As a matter of fact, in 2013, we had 5 cancers in presumptive. And one of the things that we realized throughout this, and this is where the chiefs, and I challenge all of the chiefs for every state to do this, is that legislation wrote the presumptive law in an attempt to help us. And I don't know if they did it maliciously or not, but they didn't write it well. And because they didn't write it well, there was holes in it that workers' comp was able to navigate through. So we rewrote ours. As a matter of fact, Dr. Burgess went to legislation after our results were in, because we proved to them that we were being exposed, because that's one of the things they were saying. And we now have went from 5 cancers to 21 cancers, and we have 15 years after retirement. So we really increased it, but that's just the state of Arizona, right?
Yeah.
So each state has to look at it, but it has to be done by the fire chiefs. And I will tell you that the fire chiefs have to get together and help legislation write the language so that it's a better understanding of presumptive when it comes long term.
Okay. Chief, Cap, can I ask you, were all of those cases accepted as presumptive cancer?
So our first one was denied, and that's what got us started. Since then, we've had 2 cancers. Both of them have been accepted since then. One of them was a lung cancer, one was a testicular cancer, and both of them have been accepted without any apprehension. So language was there. One, now that they had science to support it, but what's interesting is one of the workers' comp folks asked our member, the very first member, Tom Quisnell, and when he got denied and they went for a appeal, they asked his wife, which fire did he get cancer on? So they're very uneducated. Well, we have since then with this study, we've proven one. And then second thing was to show us where the research is at. So we showed them the research, and we also are proving to them that there's a thing called latency. So our exposures now doesn't mean that they're going to be here tomorrow. It means it could show up in 3 years, 5 years. There's some that can show up 30 years later. And that's why retirees are a little bit apprehensive. As they get ready to retire, they know that they're in that ending period of it. So once we educated them on latency, educated them on exposure, and then assisted them on writing that language, I think it made it easier for at least for Arizona to accept it. So since then, now there have been other cancers in other cities or other departments that have been denied, but they're the ones that are borderline presumptive. But now we have 21, they just have to do a little bit better on adding more to that, I think.
Can I ask you, is breast cancer covered?
I don't know. Chris, do you know if it's on our list of 21 in Arizona? I think it was not at one point.
So, John, I think, and I hate to put you on the spot, but I think this is a wonderful opportunity to parlay the research to the extent that you can share about, you know, we're on Women in Fire. I think this is wonderful to talk about the research that's being done on behalf of our sisters in the fire service, because it's groundbreaking and it's incredible what you guys are doing.
Certainly. So the Tucson Fire Department, University of Arizona, after we completed our 3-year study, which ended in about 2018, they started to, in 2016, started to put together a cohort called the FFCCS, Firefighter Cancer Cohort, which includes the University of Miami, NIOSH, University of Arizona, and they're doing a 30-year study. Now, unfortunately, every 3 years, it has to be, it's FEMA funded, but every 3 years, you have to come in with a concept and an idea. And currently what we're looking at is women in the fire service, but not just cancer. We're looking at AMH levels, which is a hormone that could put, they're thinking that may knock female firefighters into menopause earlier, right? So that's one of the things that they're looking at. So we're currently been onboarding fire departments. We were up in San Francisco. Dr. Burgess and his team just left Sacramento. I'm going to up to, I've been to New York, Houston, San Diego, LA to get on. And the idea behind it is to get, so it has to be a recruit females. So they're following them from the beginning of their career, right? To look at the AMH levels when they come in, but it's not just toxicant exposures, but also looking at stress and all those other things that kind of go with it. Do they also cause a fact into it? So it's not just cancer, that there are other things now this is spinning off. And like I said, with the women in the fire service, they're looking at AMH levels and reproductive. They're actually getting ready to do with University of Utah, a male reproductive study added to that. So ffccs.org, they publish everything is science-based, great researchers from Miami and University of Arizona. And I will tell you that they're finally doing something which is really important, is they're getting together and sharing concepts instead of being siloed, which is really important with the researchers. And this is that collaboration piece, because this research that we're doing is fire service led. We give them what we want, and that's the research, but we stay with them the whole way. We're with them, you know, we're holding onto their coattails as we go through this. And that's sometimes hard to do when you're, you know, you got to have a chief officer that invests in that so that I can do this. You know, it's part of my job. I still have day-to-day operations and safety, but half of my time is onboarding and being part of the research. So I have to have the chiefs invested in me to do this as well. So segue into the Women in Fire Service is not just cancer, but it's other things. And that's what we're kind of looking at. And these are answering bigger questions.
John, I just want to personally thank you, and Women in Fire want to thank you as well for the research that you are doing for women in fire, for women that are in the fire service. We tremendously appreciate that. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time. So I do want to thank my guests, especially John for all the research he's doing, Chief for your input, Heidi for sharing the policies and such that you had in your agency. I really commend all of you for everything that you're doing to try to help with this cancer in the fire service, because we know that fire service education is important to its members about safe work practice, and effective training promotes a safety culture that cultivates sound work practices. And as I think we've all stated, it starts at the company officer level, and we can't always blame everything on the fire chief and administration. And again, John, I really want to thank you for all the research that you've done. And then I want to thank Fire Engineering again for allowing Women in Fire to be on their radio show. Thanks to all the listeners and members of Women in Fire. And I'd like to remind everyone to follow Women in Fire on Facebook and Instagram, and to check out our website, womeninfire.org. And I would also like to continue this discussion maybe next month, or when everyone's available, to go a little bit more into the research aspect of it. Again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.